Ever since the invention of the movie camera, film has been used to tell stories. But artists have also used it as an experimental form to manipulate the way we experience time and space, and even to create immersive environments in which a viewer is surrounded by the work. The history of that kind of experimentation is explored in a new exhibition called Dreamlands, Immersive Cinema and Art, 1905 to 2016. It's on view at the Whitney Museum of American Art now until February 5th. And I'm pleased to welcome Chrissy Iles to our show now. She is the show's curator and author of the exhibition catalog. Is this the first major show at the Whitney Museum's new building to focus on film as an art form?
It is. The Whitney's been very committed to film and what artists have done with a moving image since its opening at the Breuer Building uptown in the 60s. And we've maintained that commitment ever since then. And this is the first large survey show of moving image work in the new building.
But immersive.
Very immersive. Very immersive.
Because that that allows for a lot more leeway when you're talking about art?
Well, I wanted to make a show about the way in which artists have used the idea of immersion, because I noticed a dramatic sea change occurring in the way artists are thinking about space and our environment, because technology has so dramatically transformed our ideas of that. And the moving image is a perfect way to immerse us.
In your catalog, you use the word haptic to describe this type of cinema. Doesn't haptic refer to a sense of touch? Do you see this kind of cinema as tactile?
Absolutely. This is not a show about cinema. It's a show about the cinematic. And by that I mean it's about the ways in which we encounter certain forms of the moving image in a way that's not going to the cinema, sitting down and watching a movie. So when you walk into the show in one piece, for example, you're walking onto reams and reams of film scattered all over the floor in a piece from 1967 by Judd Yalcott, that sort of destructive art moment. Or you're walking through the beam of light in Anthony McCall's line describing a cone that's articulated through this sort of little fog haze machine that almost creates a light sculpture out of a moving image of a circle slowly being drawn. So we're moving through the light, we're stepping onto the film or even touching it.
Does this go back to the beginnings of the history of cinema? Because we tend to think of it as a narrative art. Films are usually judged by how effectively they tell their stories. When was film first used by artists to do for more abstract purposes?
Well, in fact, the whole history of cinema in general, although it's been dominated by narrative, didn't begin like that. As the film scholar Tom Gunning has always argued, the beginnings of cinema were very much about using color in a hand applied. It was sort of hand tinted. Each film that had color right at the beginning to suggest emotion.
They used to paint on the black and white film.
Yes, and it was used to suggest emotion. So blue would suggest one thing. Rose, pink was indicative of love. The short films that appeared right at the beginnings of cinema were not narrative. They were much more about affect.
The earliest work in the show is Coney Island at Night by Edward S. Porter. And now he's best known for his 1903 film The Great Train Robbery, which is a narrative film.
Yes. Well, the reason that the Coney Island film is in the exhibition is because it's a series of four simple panning shots of the amusement park in Coney Island that had just recently opened. And the shots are all of the amusement park at night. And what you see is the park in the darkness, looming out of the darkness, illuminated by lights. So the lights seem to sort of abstract it into a kind of animation of itself.
But was this an early form of reporting?
It was not even reporting in a documentary sense. It was more recording in almost a taxonomic sense. And that's the very interesting thing about that film and why it's the earliest work in the show, is it really sort of sets up this abstracting of shapes in a kind of almost floating in the darkness.
Did most of the artists involved in the early art movements of the 20th century, Cubism, Dadaism, into Surrealism, did they all dabble in filmmaking?
They all picked up the camera. pretty much all of them. Not absolutely all of them, but many of them, just as artists in America in the 60s did, from Agnes Martin to Roy Lichtenstein. It's extraordinary how potent the camera is for artists. And the reason for that, I think, or one of the reasons, is the way in which it allows you to really explore visual optics and different ideas of space in a very expanded way.
Some of the ones that struck me most were, well, one by a German artist, Oskar Schlemmer, a triadic ballet, which was made in 1922. It features dancers dressed in toy-like costumes that might have come out of the Nutcracker or Alice in Wonderland.
Yes, Oskar Schlemmer was the head of the theater workshop at the Bauhaus in Germany. And, of course, the Bauhaus was reconfigured by Moholy Nagy for a while in Chicago when it was closed down by Hitler in the 30s. And the reason it starts the exhibition is that I wanted to articulate the historical roots of this young group of artists that half the show is about. And that moment was very potent. And Schlemmer really brought to the fore this idea of an almost robotic body floating in colored space.
But you're showing a recreation made in 1977. Does the original no longer exist?
Well, in dance, there's, like theater, there's maybe no such thing as an original, because dance is continually reperformed, and the Schlemmer piece was performed many, many times during his lifetime and has been reperformed many times since. So what we're looking at is a Bavarian television construction of that performance.
Another wonderful work from the 20s is Spacelight Art, a triptych of abstract films by Oscar Fischinger. It's kind of like a kinetic painting, but this is an artist who went on to work on Fantasia for Disney.
Yes, Oskar Fischinger was working in Berlin in the 20s. His bread and butter was making special effects for the newly emergent film industry, but he was a painter and he was experimenting with abstract moving forms, as were many German filmmakers and artists, which really differentiated them from the sort of more literary-based experiments with film by the artists over in Paris.
I'm speaking with Chrissy Iles about Dreamlands, Immersive Cinema and Art, 1905 to 2015, currently at the Whitney Museum of American Art and running until February 5th. Some of the artists, a lot of artists tried their hand at famous artists like Joseph Cornell. He has Rose Hobart from 1936, a 20-minute blue-tinted compilation of excerpts from a Hollywood movie called East of Borneo. And they all feature the actress Rose Hobart, projected through blue glass and set in to Brazilian music. Did he set it to Brazilian music?
No. In fact, it was silent when he first showed it, so I'm showing it silently in this exhibition. It's showing on a loop in the gallery for the first time. What happened was Cornell loved to frequent junk stores and flea markets, and he found this print of the Hollywood movie East of Borneo. And what he did was he cut it up and extracted all the most emotional shots from the film and reassembled it into a very, therefore, sort of emotionally charged film and projected it through a blue glass, piece of blue glass that he found, which creates this very sort of surreal quality. And it was silent originally. He played some records, some Brazilian records later on, 30 years later. But at the first showing, which Salvador Dali attended, it was silent. And Dali famously said, "I had that idea. He stole it from my unconscious." So
it's the same Joseph Cornell, who's known for his collage boxes. Can't a film made up of splice pieces be thought of as a collage in a way?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And collage is one of the very interesting ways in which filmmakers and artists have really pulled apart the conventional idea of what narrative is to create something much more experiential and immersive.
A very different response is evoked by Bruce Conner's Crossroads, a montage of military footage of the atomic bomb test at Bikini Atoll that's set to two very different soundtracks. How did he gain access to these military films?
Well, those films became declassified. The military, I think it was about over 300 films and photographs, photographers and filmmakers were recording the Bikini Atoll atomic tests in 1946. It's the most photographed and filmed event until 9/11. And by the time Bruce Conner found them, they were declassified, so he was able to have access to them, and he didn't alter them in any way. They were filmed in extreme slow motion by the military so that the effect of the explosion could be studied, and he merely sort of put them together in this very mesmerizing and almost shocking but completely hypnotic sequence where you see the same explosion from many, many different angles.
There's an installation by Alex DeCourt and Jason Musson called Eastern Sports, which has videos projected onto four facing screens along with sound, light, decor, and the scent of oranges. Is this the only piece to include the sense of smell?
It is. I mean,
there were experiments at one point in smell-o-vision, but I don't think it went very far.
Well, I think one of the interesting things is how popular this idea of immersive experience is at the moment. And, of course, artists are articulating that as well in their own field. And so what Alex and Jason, and also this is a musical score by the composer Dev Hynes, who's synesthetic, he hears colour. So what the artists did was they created a sort of cinema in the round.
Then there's one that uses 3D glasses, but you don't have anything in the show that involves virtual reality. Wouldn't that also be called immersive cinema?
I mean, the point of the show is that it's physically immersive. Mm-hmm. Virtual reality, I deliberately didn't include it because you could watch virtual reality at home, on the subway. With virtual reality glasses, the physical space you're surrounded by disappears. But in fact, what I wanted to do in the show is immerse the viewer physically in space and actually present something to you that you can't experience in any other way. And that's particularly important, I feel, at the moment, because our main experience of large-scale projective images is commercial. And this is a very different experience of what large projection can do and communicate.
Hito Stervall's Stayerl's Factory of the Sun is a film that's set in the future where people have to dance to create sunlight. And it's shown in a room where viewers sit in lounge chairs surrounded by a projected grid, a combination of science fiction and video game.
Maybe, yes. I mean, I think that
But the viewers are part of the film.
Well, it's very interesting because when you step inside this very digital-looking grid, which is actually a large black room with blue tape up and down the walls and the floor and the ceiling to create almost like a CGI motion capture screen, you feel like you're inside a motion capture screen and you're part of the film, you're part of the video game, if you like.
You include concept drawings for landmark films like Disney's Fantasia. Why was that film so important to the history of immersive cinema?
Well, Fantasia was Disney's most experimental film, and it was interesting the way in which at that point in 1940, just as war was breaking out in Europe, and Disney had spent so much time in Germany, he was thinking about the physical space of the theater, the sort of commercial theatre, and trying to create a sense of immersiveness through the sound of the music, almost driving the image rather than the other way around. So if you look at the sequences in Fantasia, they're very, very specifically constructed and created. It's almost like a musical score through colour.
And it also introduced kids to classical music.
It did.
Tell us about Terrence Broad's Blade Runner auto-encoded. Is it a reimagining of Ridley Scott's film?
No, what happened is Terrence Broad, who's a young artist who's also a computer scientist, he built an artificial intelligence brain, and he showed the artificial intelligence brain Blade Runner, and the artificial intelligence brain memorized Blade Runner frame by frame. So the result, and what you see both in the galleries and then we're doing a theatrical screening of it in January, is the AI brain's memory of Blade Runner. So the images are all slightly blurred, but it is Blade Runner, mm-hmm. but it's slightly blurred. So it's almost like looking at someone's dream, which is sort of ironic given that Blade Runner is all about the sort of indivisibility between the replicant and the human. And so when we, I'm looking forward to seeing the film in the theatre where one would normally see Blade Runner and seeing what that difference is.
There's an extensive program of screenings to go with this exhibition.
There are. There's screenings and also an expanded cinema program that we're collaborating with Microscope Gallery in Bushwick in Brooklyn on. And so there are 14 screening programs of single screen films. And then the expanded cinema events that Microscope Gallery are doing in collaboration with us have been fantastic, reconstructing things from the 1920s as well as contemporary works.
Chrissy Iles is Anne and Joel Ehrenkranz curator at the Whitney Museum. She has curated this exhibit, Dreamlands, Immersive Cinema and Art, 1905-2016. It's on view at the Whitney Museum of American Art at 99 Gansford Street until February 5th of next year. Thank you so much for being on our show. For more information, by the way, go to our show page at WNYC.org.